Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimpsey for Reality Check Radio. We'll take a retrospective on key events from the previous week. And also, as we wind down for this year, we only have these weekly roundups that are being broadcast live on RCR. And there's one more next week, so please do tune in then as well before everything is wrapped up for the year and we'll all go on holiday. And then after that, of course, the show will return next year as usual. I am still doing two extra interviews, standalone interviews that are going straight to RCR Replay. And this week's one is with Keegan Langeveld from Young New Zealand First. So be sure to check that out after you have finished listening to this weekly roundup. Welcome back to the show, William. It's good to have you back to discuss these events.
Yeah, well, it's been eventful. So there's a lot to discuss there.
Absolutely. And probably the biggest news we had here in New Zealand last week, came in late last week, was the report, interim report on the sinking of the HMNZS Manawanui. And, well, was it what the pundits, the people who were speculating what went wrong, was there any grounding to what those people were saying? Because, of course, the Navy themselves, the government, was very quick to kind of say, no, this wasn't due to diversity. It was just a terrible tragedy. It was all a mistake. And looking at this report, it was pretty clear that from the get-go, everybody knew what had gone wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's incompetence, right? So they've ruled out something going wrong with the boat and attributed it to human error. And it was really a comedy of errors. If you look into the media conference and what they were telling us, they told us they left the autopilot on. And of course, if you have the autopilot on, then when you try and manually steer, the boat doesn't respond. So they were doing a turn. They tried to keep turning, didn't respond. Then it was driving straight towards the reef. And so rather than, as a standard procedure, checking whether the autopilot was on or off and turning it off if it was on so you could take the controls manually, they, I don't know what they did. Maybe they panicked and they thought, well, there must be a problem with the thrusters, the directional control system. So they'd sent people down to have a look, see if they could figure out what was wrong there. And they mucked around for 10 minutes while they were heading towards the reef. Wasn't that. Then they tried to turn the thrusters around and accelerate backwards. But of course, if you're in autopilot, the directions don't work, but the acceleration does. And so they accelerated right onto the reef and ran into ground, bumping along the bottom of the reef for a while until the ship
I've got the exact distance here. They ran over the reef for 635 meters.
And what's unbelievable about this? So that's obvious incompetence.
At full speed, obviously. Yeah, yeah. 10 knots, say full speed. It says here at the speed of 10 knots, they ran over the reef for a good long distance.
They had a fail-safe system in place. There's one person driving the ship. There's a supervisor. And then presumably there's the captain or whoever else is on the bridge as the commanding officer at the time. And all three of those people failed to notice the obvious thing that the autopilot was on and turn it off.
And based on the photo that they showed us as well at the press conference and they've got on the report, it's pretty clear if you're standing on the bridge, you know, where the autopilot is, and if you look at it, you should be able to see that it's on. It's not some magical red light that's hidden that somebody might be hunched over and that nobody else can see.
Yeah, and somebody had turned it on because it was on. And so they must have known that the autopilot was there and it could be turned on. Someone had turned it on, but they didn't think to turn it off. And you could also, so it's hard to understand how a mistake so obvious could be made by all of the people responsible when they had a fail-safe system like that. It speaks to some sort of awful incompetence. It's hard to understand how that could have happened.
Well, we know what the New Zealand Defence Force has been focused on in recent times. They've bragged about their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. They got senior officers signing special pledges. They say they've got a special gender equality pledge that they get all of the senior officers to sign, where they take courses in how to treat women well, how to handle diverse peoples, and getting Rainbow Tech certified. And this seems to be something that the Navy has been bragging on about. And of course, the defense forces in general, they were talking about how great it is that they've put women in charge of the ships. It doesn't really, I mean, maybe they're competent, but like nobody can know. Are these people competent? We've clearly had a case here where they had three people on that bridge that were not competent.
Was the captain one of them, I guess, is the real question. Did the DEI hire captain, as she's being described, was she responsible for mucking up? I mean, she's the captain, so ultimately she's responsible, but we don't know precisely how involved she was in this string of failed decision-making.
And well, they had a press conference early on, right after this had happened, and said, oh, people are bullying online, armchair admirals. They had this big show, the government and Judith Collins even, talking about how the online pundits were wrong and people needed to be quiet and so on. But then we look at the actual report and we see that they figured out that the autopilot was on and they disengaged it after they had run onto the reef. So by the time that they'd abandoned the ship and gotten onto land and phoned it in, they could have figured out it was an autopilot error. So it was human error. They could have known that right from the beginning. And clearly, I don't know whether it was a cover-up or not, it's completely wrong focus, where it's a complete failure of their diversity policies and just trying to cover it up. And then, yeah, well,
what was the captain driving the boat at the time? That's what I'm asking. Was the captain herself driving the boat?
Basically, did she know?
And did they try and cover up the fact that they made an obvious stupid error when they got off the boat? Because you're right, they would have known straight away as soon as they got off, because they did actually turn the autopilot off 10 minutes after they'd crashed, or whatever the time frame was. So they knew they'd up. But that didn't come out in the reporting immediately after the event.
And this is, of course, just the interim report. They said they're doing further investigation into what's going on here. Do you think there's going to be any serious investigation that the Navy is going to do into their policies of how they hire staff, how they train staff, what they're focusing on? Because in terms of naval incidents in New Zealand, this is the second autopilot issue that we've actually had. It was the ferries several months ago, one of the inter-island ferries that ran aground on an autopilot issue. You'd think that this is something that they would be aware of.
Yeah, there seems to be a problem with training people how to turn the autopilot on and off within our maritime industry within New Zealand. Something they'll have to get onto, yeah.
And yeah, I'm trying to see if there's anything else in this report maybe that you think would be worth talking about. Like I said, obviously, we just basically have the timeline and the fact that they're doing further investigations. Very, very embarrassing for the Rear Admiral as well, having to front this press conference. He looked very sort of uncomfortable with what had gone on.
Yes, that's true. And the other thing is that there's a boat that's been sunk that's spewing pollution, diesel, out into the water, and the Samoans are very unhappy about that. And they're looking to see if they can get some sort of compensation for that. And so we may end up, we as New Zealanders, being on the hook for compensating Samoa for some of the pollution that's come out of that boat as well. So that's another aspect of it.
Yeah, it's difficult to see how well they will clean that up. And of course, whether or not they leave the ship on the reef or refloat her, those decisions seem to still be ongoing. The last I think I heard on that was that they were sort of thought, oh, well, whatever, we'll just have to leave it there, which, you know, these ships become part of the reef and the wildlife is perfectly happy with that. But of course, an incredibly expensive mistake that will end up costing us at minimum hundreds of millions of dollars. And that is a catastrophe for which at least someone should get, you know, someone very, very senior should get fired for those kinds of failures, if not multiple people higher up, people responsible for the training, possibly, unless, of course, the training was correct. We still have no details into what kind of the level of incompetence was on that boat, whether or not any of the people there were paying attention, maybe they were having a party, who knows what was going on, because they haven't revealed that yet.
No, there's the people involved in crashing the boat. There's the people involved in implementing the DEI policies across the Navy. is the politicians themselves, because this stuff comes from the very top, doesn't it? The idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion being more important than basic competence in positions of leadership and authority. And we're seeing the consequences of it, that this is what happens when you don't have the most competent people in charge. You're pandering to various groups in society in order to achieve diversity targets. You sacrifice competence, and then that results in poor decisions being made. It results in the destruction of multi-million dollar naval vessels. And it's not just naval vessels, it's across every area of our society. Everything functions worse when you don't have the best people for the job in those positions. And it just makes everyone suffer, and society, it degrades society and degrades the potential of us as a collective and of each individual when we don't have the most competent people in the positions of power and authority.
And I should add as well that these policies actually decrease the pool of competent people that are available, because you drive away the good people. They go somewhere else, or maybe they've been pushed out. Maybe they've been told they're no longer welcome. And you see this across industries, for instance, where conservatives, Christians are told, no, you're not welcome. Your views are not welcome. We don't want you here. We're implementing these policies by which you will be forced out of the organization. Or as we had a few years ago with the entire defense force, of course, the Navy and other industries as well, but focusing on the defense forces here, vaccine mandates, various policies, or somebody who said, look, I've got a conscientious objection. I can't do this. This is not moral. Or, hey, you can't force my, if you had a commanding officer who would stand up and say, hey, I'm not going to force my people into this. This is immoral. Well, those people have all been shoved aside. They've all been kicked out of the military. I know some of them myself. They've been running a court case against the defense force and done quite well. And they've won in the most recent cases, basically saying, hey, this was even not legal for the defense force to do. But guess what? No apology, no actual change in policy. They just shrug off the legal costs and the slap on the wrist, and they just carry on.
Well, I'm a refugee from the working in the government bureaucracy for very similar reasons to that. You literally feel like you can't get ahead, and you're treated as sort of a hostile interloper if you're a sort of conservative person.
Working. Yeah, and that means, that means that talking about hiring the best person for the job, you're not even going to have the best people there to hire in the first place, even if you're passing them over, because they've already left.
We see this in academia, we see this in the bureaucracy, we see this in the media, that once you get to a certain point, you get into a downward spiral where you have ideological self-selection, and all the people with the different and disagreeing ideology selected themselves out of the pool, or are selected out of the pool by the hostile culture that's created. And those people aren't leaving because they're incompetent or they're not the best people. They're leaving because they feel like they're not welcome, or that they're being discriminated against, or that they can't get ahead, or that the culture is just too different and hostile and unwelcoming, and it's not a friendly place for them to be. So our society has gone like that, and across a number of key areas, the opinion shaping institutions, and even into big business now, and it's having really serious consequences.
And speaking of locking people out of particular roles or places, we have had the news as well from Immigration New Zealand that they have declined a visa for Candace Owens, and this follows a decision Australia made. And the New Zealand immigration bureaucrats, paper pushers, middle managers came up with an excuse. They said, oh, well, she'd been banned from Australia, and because she's been banned from another country, she can't come here. Of course, they didn't go into why she had been banned from Australia. She hadn't been banned from Australia for any legitimate reason. She'd been banned for her beliefs. Her freedom of speech was something that became the primary target for left-wing bureaucrats in Australia, and left-wing bureaucrats in New Zealand simply followed suit. And now we no longer have Candace Owens coming to speak in New Zealand.
Yeah, well, I mean, that rule is supposed to weed out people who are criminal nuisances or terrorist threats or threats to national security, people like that. And Candace Owens is none of those things. She just has views that some people disagree with. So that's why Australia declined her visa. They didn't want someone coming in talking about views that perhaps the Jewish community don't like. And the Free Speech Union have said, well, Immigration New Zealand are misusing that law because the definition of exclusion doesn't mean, you know, not granting someone a visa because people don't like their views. It's about excluding people who are, like I say, terrorists or criminal nuisance or a threat to national security or something like that.
Yeah, and the reason that's in the law, by the way, is simply to save some time and effort, basically, to say, okay, has another country banned this person? Yes, we can check up on that and see, okay, right, they've been banned for XYZ reason. We don't need to do a whole massive investigation ourselves. But if you see the reason is obviously bogus, well, then you shouldn't be using that clause. That clause is just there as a starting point to see, okay, well, why is this country banned that person? And they clearly don't have a legitimate reason to ban her. Otherwise, they would have gone for one of the other legitimate options. And complete silence here from the National Party as well. This is Erica Stanford's portfolio. Seems like she's pretty happy with this, actually. I don't think I've heard anything from her.
Yeah, well, there's enough people milling around in Immigration New Zealand with an ideological axe to grind that they can find, you know, laws or policies to make the decision that they want to, you know, to justify the decision they want to make anyway. And I think we have a National Party at the core of this government. It's a government I support, I think is doing some good things. But there's a National Party at the core of it who have a let's not rock the boat, let's not make a fuss sort of mentality. And so they're not willing to take on difficult fights that I think you really do need to take on the difficult fights is the issue.
Yeah, and especially if you're a minister, you should lay out to these departments what you expect from them. She could have very easily said, I expect Immigration New Zealand that you will uphold people's freedom of speech rights when you're making decisions. Much in the same way that I can give a good example of a minister who basically did something like this, which was the police minister, Mark Mitchell, where on his first day, he sent a letter to the police saying, I expect you to enforce the laws. We're going to be passing a bunch of new laws in the very near future. I expect you to enforce those heavily. And that's basically what police have been doing when it comes to, say, the new gang patch laws and so on. They've been arresting people left, right, and center, gang members for displaying gang patches. Now, you can say, hey, the law's an imperfect law, the law's a bad law, whatever. But the police are actually doing what the government has instructed them to do. And the police tend to be, you know, have a little bit more of a claim to independence, operational independence, than other departments do. So they can't really use this excuse to say, oh, well, this is a matter for the people in the department. No, the minister is directly responsible for this, and she should be owning up to it. And this goes across all these government departments. You simply have too many ministers, especially as you said in the National Party, who are just not serious about this, and they need to have a little bit of fire lit under them.
Yeah, well, the people expect when they elect a government that they're electing the government to introduce and push through the policy agenda that they campaigned on. But if the elected members aren't forceful enough in directing the public sector departments to do what they want, people need to understand that the bureaucracy has a sort of agenda of its own, and it will go along and it will write its papers and it will make its recommendations to the ministers. This is what people don't, I don't think a lot of people already understand, that these departments are drafting up their own recommendations about what needs to be done and presenting them to ministers. And that process will go along. They'll be going, drafting up papers to ministers saying, do you want to do this? Do you want to do this? We think something needs to be done in this area. The bureaucracy, in effect, is a political actor with its own agenda that will try and co-opt ministers into doing what they want. And if the ministers aren't forceful enough to push back and say to the public sector, no, we're in charge and we're implementing our agenda, you need to do what we tell you, then they're just going to end up being co-opted and doing what the bureaucracy was doing all along.
Yeah, and these bureaucrats will then go to the media. They leak these things to the media, and they get the media, which is also a political actor, a partisan political actor, and they will then work with the bureaucracy to try and get rid of these ministers, or to attack the ministers, to undermine them. And you see this all the time in the media, right? Minister has ignored advice, blah, 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 blah. No, that advice came from the bureaucrats, who have a different political agenda to the minister. We elected those ministers to ignore the advice of the bureaucrats, because the bureaucrats are wrong and we want to defeat the bureaucrats. And of course, the media is part of this. And so you have these ministers who are too afraid of this. And I've spoken with former ministers in the past and they say, oh, actually, you've got a lot less power. You know, when you're in there, you think you can get a lot less done. Well, a lot of that is simply because of that containment pressure that has been created. And then, of course, there's that pressure on these ministers to not break containment. And when really that's the only thing they should be doing, that should be their focus, is how do we break containment out of the bureaucracy, and how do we force the bureaucracy to do what the voters have elected us to do? And in this case, for instance, with Candace Owens and free speech not being upheld, it is a very blatant failure of the government to uphold what the voters put them in there for, which is to have more freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech is very explicit, and it's outlined in the coalition agreement, and they're not sort of upholding to the spirit of that in this case. I think in the past, we have had sort of a culture of upholding certain ethical commitments in our important institutions that has made them more neutral. So there's an idea of public sector neutrality. There's an idea of media objectivity or neutrality. We've had ideas in academia about teaching people how to think and not what to think, not being about ideological indoctrination. Those moral commitments at the heart of those institutions have fallen away now, and they've all become politicized. They're all pushing an agenda. Now, I think there's a legitimate philosophical debate to be had about whether neutrality is really ever possible in institutions. But just as a sort of a practical observation, things were less politicized in the past, I think, and they have become more politicized now. All our key opinion-making institutions are politicized, so people in there have agendas, and elected representatives, politicians, really need to come to terms with that and figure out strategies for dealing with it. They're not walking into an environment where you have a bunch of institutions who are at your beck and call, willing to do what you want. You're dealing with political actors, and if you're a conservative, in many cases, they're all hostile to you. So there needs to be a rethink about how you deal with that. And I think conservative parties across the Western world, I think Trump is one of them, but also in other places, they're sort of clicking onto this now and starting to think about how we actually deal with this situation.
And one more thing from Australia then, before we move on to some of the other Anglosphere countries for a quick update. Do you have anything extra that you think is worth commenting on from the social media bill that's continued to progress through Australian politics and Australian Parliament, where effectively the bill states that it will ban social media for under 16s, but in reality will basically implement ID verification required to access social media accounts and social media platforms. And of course, as you've raised last week, that of course this doesn't apply to, say, actually harmful things on the internet, things for that will be actually harmful for under 16s, like pornography and so on. This is purely targeting speech platforms and claiming that that's harming children, when of course there are a dozen things that we could think of that are far more harmful for these children.
Yeah, well, the Australian Senate tried to cram through 30 different bills on the last sitting day of the year, this bill being one of them, and they passed it. And this happened after they gave one day for submissions on the bill. So there hasn't been a proper democratic process on this rather important bill that takes away the free speech rights of a portion of the community, usurps the parental authority of Australian people, requires digital identification for all citizens logging onto social media, and potentially has scary consequences in terms of the ability to expand this censorship apparatus. So the free speech of people is not just taken away by the bill. The free speech of people was taken away in the process of passing the bill as well. So, a terrible situation, but that may come back to bite the Australian Labor government, I think. I think they're setting themselves up for potential legal challenges here.
Yeah, so the latest update I saw here was that at least mostly theories at this point, but it seems likely that some of the platforms, especially Elon Musk's X, will take them to court, basically, on as saying that this bill violates the Constitution, the Australian Constitution, on people's rights to access information and impart information freely, much like we have in our Bill of Rights. And so you can expect a lot of a protracted fight there. If it actually comes into effect, I think that Australians will view it very, very negatively, and it's going to impact the Labor Party very badly over there, especially when people have to experience the consequences of the bill.
Yeah, because it will have consequences for everyone, not just for children. And sort of that's the thing. Do you really want to be, verifying your identity to create a social media account or to log on? A lot of people like to log on anonymously. And that's had, as I've said before, that's had huge positive consequences for free speech. So how are a lot of anonymous social media users going to have to feel to verify their identity to set up an account or log on? I think there's going to be a lot of people who are upset by that.
Now, we have had an interesting development in Canada and the United Kingdom. So, just last week, Justin Trudeau released a video saying immigration has been too high. There's been too much immigration into Canada, and he is going to be slowing down the rate of immigration. And he talked very seriously about how it's negatively impacted the economy. And this seems to be a focus that didn't really talk about the cultural aspects, the ethnic aspects, but just purely from the economic aspects. Whereas he'd been for years touting economic benefits of high migration, now suddenly the economic benefits are seen as a negative. And then it was revealed as well, just after he made that speech and released a video of him talking about how high immigration was bad, that there are up to 5 million people in Canada whose visas expire in the next year, or next 2 years. I forget the exact timetable, that they expect to voluntarily leave Canada. So that's 5 million people potentially who would be leaving Canada, and their population would be shrinking massively. I don't really see him following through on that, but that's just an interesting thing that he's talking about it. And of course, a few days later, Keir Starmer in the UK followed up as well, saying the immigration numbers in the UK are too high. The Conservative government opened the borders. He criticized their open border policy. They used Brexit to run an experiment on the United Kingdom and open the borders. And again, he focused very much on the negative economic effects, less so cultural and ethnic and religious and social consequences, but economic consequences. And he's going to reduce immigration as well. So, what do you think about that, William? This whole year, I mean, we're here near the end of the year, beginning of December. When we first had you on the show in February, we talked about immigration. Here we are. The biggest liberals in the Western world, Justin Trudeau and Keir Starmer, they're talking about immigration just like you are.
Well, that's a positive thing, isn't it? I think it's sort of becoming harder and harder to ignore or pretend that there are real negative consequences from these very high rates of immigration. And it's the negative consequences aren't just apparent for people like me, for example, who might be concerned about some of the cultural effects of the negative cultural things that result from diversity and multiculturalism and having too many ethnic minorities that creates sort of a cultural clash within your country. It's just the basic economic effects are sort of too hard to ignore, and I think that's what's motivating a lot of these liberal people. The effect on the housing market, the effect on infrastructure, the effect on basic public services, it becomes very difficult to cater to the basic economic needs of people when you're bringing in so many people at once. The economy can't adjust. You can't adjust your supplies of housing, infrastructure, and public services quickly enough to accommodate the growing population. And I think that's perhaps what's motivating it. It creates an interesting conundrum for people like me who are conservative but are concerned about immigration when it's the left-wing parties that are now talking about reducing immigration more than the conservative parties. So, I'm torn between my conservative beliefs on the one hand and my desire to reduce immigration on the other. So you have to your the things you value are sort of split in half in terms of which parties you vote
Well,
for.
traditionally, the left has been more so opposed to immigration because it hurts the workers. The workers were the traditional base of these left-wing parties. And in the United States, you've seen a massive shift now. The working class votes for Trump, votes Republican, because they're talking about immigration, and that is, has the worst negative effects. People who experience the negative effects are working class people, especially the depression on wages. reduction in jobs available, because again, as much as people talk about high skill immigration, the reality is it's almost all what we would call low skill immigration. We talked a few weeks ago about the actual concrete stats we have in New Zealand now, that 98.6% of immigration is low skill. I mean, that figure actually probably holds up in many Western countries, if they were being honest. So it's the working class who are very much concerned, and that's traditionally what you would say a left-wing voting bloc. And these are socially conservative people, but the left wing, again, the old left in New Zealand as well, used to be socially conservative, and they used to be very concerned about immigration. So perhaps both Trudeau and Starmer, who are becoming increasingly popular, are trying to tap back into this. So how serious they're being, we don't know. Maybe it's a cynical ploy. But as you say, the fact that they're talking about it is already a really big thing.
Yeah, as long as they do it, if they get into power, that's what counts, whether they're being cynical.
Well, they're both in power already. So
what their real beliefs are is sort of less important to me than what.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you'll see in a year's time, have they been honest, right? They're both talking about it now. It's only a year later that you could really look at the numbers and say, okay, yes, they were being honest.
Yeah, but you're right. The economic arguments in terms of reducing immigration and the effects on wages for the working class, this is something that has been known for a long time. It's sort of basic economics, basic conventional economics, that if you import large numbers of low-wage workers particularly, you depress the wages in your own country. And of course, wages are the major source of income for people. So depressing wages is obviously bad for the basic economic well-being of your workers. Everyone knows that, but we get the large numbers of immigrants anyway for a number of reasons, because big business likes having a big pool of labor. They like paying people less. And a lot of left-wing parties have thought it's going to be easier to put together a voting coalition with all these this coalition of minorities that they're importing into the country. So that's another reason. Then there's this
sort of, now that you mentioned that, I wonder if Trump's victory recently, and he did quite well with certain of these ethnic minorities, even talking about lowering immigration and doing mass deportations. I wonder if Trudeau and Starmer are getting worried. They're scared, hey, if someone who's extremely right-wing by their standards can run on that platform and win, you know, even with the replacement voters that they're importing, they may very well be worried that the replacement voters they've imported will turn on them, just like the ones in America have.
Well, what you have to understand is a lot of these immigrant people they are importing, they like the material living standards in Western countries, but they don't share the liberal social norms at all. These people often have what the liberals would consider a backward, socially conservative views from the places that they come from. The Latin Americans, for example, they appreciate Trump's sort of bombastic personality. They tend to elect leaders like that in Latin America. They like them. So a lot of the, I think, assumptions that they made about how they could buy these immigrant voting blocks off with a combination of economic incentives and by cultivating a culture of sort of hatred for the white majority through anti-colonial narratives and all this sort of stuff, maybe that's not going to be effective.
And that definitely will be quite interesting to watch in the next few years. And as I said, in America, Trump talking about mass deportations and closing the borders and saying what the liberals all said were nasty, horrible things, racist things about immigrants, didn't impact him negatively at all when it came to the ballot box. So we shall see how that develops. Very, very interesting overseas. And I'm definitely going to come back to this, you know, next year, later on in the year, of course, and we can actually say, okay, did they follow through? Because that's the interesting, that's the proof in the pudding. Now, another report that we had in New Zealand, and this may be our last item for today, but you know, it's as we've said, it's been a busy week. COVID report, the phase one COVID report has been released, and there seem to be some mixed reactions to it. Some people saying it's a whitewash. Other people, and even the author of the report, were saying, hey, people are going to be pleasantly surprised. There's criticisms of the government in here. So what do you say? What's your initial impression of this COVID report?
Well, there's good and bad in it. Let's start with the bad. So I've read the summary report. So the section on vaccination is basically terrible. as far as the authors of the report are concerned, a vaccination was a great thing, and we would all have been better off if we'd have vaccinated everyone more quickly and more often and focused harder on getting more vaccinations. There's no acknowledgement that we were promised a vaccine that would stop transmission and prevent people getting seriously ill, and that was safe and had very little side effects. And none of those things turned out to be true. It did not prevent transmission, did not prevent people getting seriously ill. And there were many people who had adverse reactions to it. So that section was terrible. But phase two of the inquiry is going to focus more on questions of vaccine safety and efficacy. So hopefully that addresses those issues.
To be the devil's advocate here, the people on the other side of this tended to criticize the government a little bit on that issue of vaccine, saying, yeah, the government didn't roll things out fast enough. Because I remember at the time, there were criticisms of the government that it was all going too slow, and I struggled to exactly remember the details there, but it was a case of at least a month or 2 months or 3 months where they held stuff back. And at the end, it didn't make a difference, right? It didn't change the effectiveness. They didn't run extra tests on it. They just dilly-dallied around. So it's interesting to see that criticism in the report, because I remember that at the time. And of course, it wouldn't have made a difference to the effectiveness or the safeness or any of the whatever else they were. They were simply too slow, and they simply covered it up later and said, oh yes, we were really fast. And then they, of course, applied extra pressure onto New Zealanders and did all kinds of horrible things. But from their own side, I think it's a very fair criticism.
Yeah. So the basic narrative this report spins is that New Zealand's COVID response initially was very good. We had an elimination strategy. We locked down the borders. We focused on rolling out vaccines. And we had MIQ, we used lockdowns and mandates well. And that elimination strategy worked and resulted in us having low rates of infection and low rates of fatality compared to other countries in the early stages. But then the report goes on to say, we lacked a strategy from exiting from the elimination strategy, because of course you can't eliminate a virus forever, because it just becomes endemic in the population and you can't seal your country off from the rest of the world perpetually.
Well, there were people who genuinely believe that. There were people who were genuinely arguing for that. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why the shift didn't happen. I'll let you continue on that point in the moment. At the moment, I very much do remember you had a bunch of insane, crazy people who were affronting the media every single day, and they were running hysterical stories, reprogramming the masses in real time with this kind of insane hysteria. And I don't know if the report addresses the fact that, you know, these were basically government paid propagandists who were doing that.
Yeah, all the pandemics. I mean, someone can come on and tell me I'm wrong about this, but in all pandemics, the virus starts out with more sort of lethal potential, and then it mutates over time to become more benign, and then it sort of becomes endemic in the population, and it just becomes part of the general sort of bug going around.
Yeah, and
part of daily life.
The saying, New Zealand had lower rates of fatalities early on. Yes, that's only because we essentially outsourced the fatalities to countries who did less well then, so that the virus could mutate there and then be less fatal over here.
An elimination strategy can only ever be a tool to blunt the initial impact. It can never be a long-term strategy you do forever. But, and yeah, you're right, there did seem to be people who didn't get that basic point, but that's a bit odd. But what they said was, so elimination strategy worked well initially. There was no strategy in the long run to transition away from that. And so we ended up relying on these tools like lockdowns and mandates. And we used them perhaps in a more widespread and stringent manner than was warranted. And that caused real harms and social division and trouble with our social cohesion. That is a significant concession, I think, to the view that people like me have.
And Voices for Freedom did amazing work there. We see that the author of the report, whose name I can't remember, he credited Voices for Freedom as well on engaging with him and changing his mind on some issues and things that he included in the report there to say, as you said, there were a large minority of people who were very negatively impacted. And even though most of the report was a whitewash, to get that acknowledgement in phase one, I think bodes very, very well for what's still going to come with phase two.
Yeah, so that was the good part of the report. There was an acknowledgement that lockdowns, mandates, and perhaps some of the other measures went too far and caused harms. But then we move on and we look at the recommendations that the report lays down. And what you see is they think the solution to future pandemics is to have a big pandemic bureaucracy, similar to what Australia recommended and is now setting up, that will, you know, have this ability to do strategic thinking and change things quickly so we don't end up with a situation where we're using lockdowns and mandates more too stringently in the future, because we've got all the big brains thinking about it and thinking about the best strategy. And we can do things in more flexible ways. So it looks like if the recommendations of this report are heeded, we're going to have a big new pandemic bureaucracy.
Which, of course, is going to do the opposite of what they say it's going to do. It would be a terrible situation. And of course, it had no recognition as well on just how evil the restrictions were on people who were locked out of dying loved ones, final moments with people, all of that ripped away for no good reason. And forcefully, of course, if people chose not to, you know, if people chose to isolate themselves, that's one thing. But they completely ripped that away. No acknowledgement of the harms to people being able to worship, to conduct their religion. I guess the oppression that we had as well, the restrictions on freedom of speech and protests as well. We just, you know, obviously a couple of weeks ago had the charges against Brian Tumaki dropped, but there was a whole bunch of that with, you know, the government under the guise of pandemic activity completely oppressed people's basic rights. And that a real pandemic recommendation would say, okay, that's not allowed. That's not worth it. That's never worth it. That should never happen again. And that's what I would want to see in a recommendation, and not even a hint of that here.
There was far too much talk about the problems of mis and disinformation in this report for my liking. If we go back and remember where this term of mis and disinformation come from, it came from the government, not just in New Zealand, but in many countries around the world, wanting to control the messaging, the public health messaging around the pandemic, to make sure that only their message was getting out. And of course, in a democracy, in a free country, a lot of people have different opinions. They disagree with the public health advice. In many cases, we had doctors, medical practitioners, academics disagreeing with the government's medical advice. And those people came under all sorts of Orwellian types of censorship. We had medical boards, the medical council, trying to shut people down and shut people up so that they couldn't express dissenting views. We had professional bodies in many other areas cancelling people, firing them if they expressed views, you know, on social media in their own time, disagreeing with the government's pandemic messaging. So the pandemic really coincided with this implementation of an Orwellian thought control system. I mean, we always had this to some extent, but never as intensely or as obviously connected to a single piece of public policy, such as the pandemic response, the pandemic management strategy. And so that, I just think that crystallized things in a lot of people's heads that, you know, that the government is really Orwellian and not on the side of free speech.
And well, if the official report isn't factoring that in, we certainly are. And, you know, many, many people, many organizations around the world have been formed. And I think we will remember this forever. And of course, the information next time, because there will be a next time, you know, even if it's 100 years from now, we need to make sure that the good information is available to people so that they don't have to suffer. You know, maybe future generations then will not have to suffer through what we did, and they'll have the tools to fight back against it. There's some positive news around this. You know, we've obviously had the COVID inquiry here, and they haven't got one in the United States, but they have got the author of the Great Barrington Declaration has been selected by Trump to lead one of the national, I forget which one it is, one of the national health agencies, slightly different to the one that RFK Jr. is involved with, which is, again, is a very great and positive sign, because this was a man, he was a man who was canceled and vilified. And well, guess what? He's now, you know, at least Trump has now recognized that that he was right about this.
Yes, and it's a Jay Bhattacharya or something like that. Is that how you say his name? Something like that.
Might be, I'm sorry, I couldn't pronounce his name, so I left it off. But you gave it a better shot than I could have.
But yeah, well, I apologize. That's probably not the best pronunciation either. But Yes, and his comments on social media announced that he's going right after the pharmaceutical companies. He's going right after many of the other vested interests that had that were involved in, you know, there's this sort of open door between the big bureaucracies in the US and pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, RFK Jr. has talked about this, agricultural lobbyists and other people as well. But for the purposes of the pandemic, more the pharmaceutical companies. And that creates conflicts of interest that you can't have if you want to get, you know, transparency and accountability and good decision-making. You can't have those sorts of conflicts.
Yeah, and they then colluded with social media companies to silence people as well. And so, you know, he was on a Twitter blacklist, as Elon Musk revealed in the Twitter files, that they had had completely blacklisted him. So I guess the best revenge in this case is to be the one put in charge of cleaning it up and making sure it doesn't happen again. Unfortunately, we didn't quite get a news that good in New Zealand, but COVID report round two has officially begun. You can submit on that as well. Give your feedback to the committees that are being set up. And I think Voices for Freedom, Reality Check Radio are going to do a lot of work in helping people with that. So keep your eye out on your inboxes for all of that as well.
That's right. Yep.
And that's it for today. Thank you very much for listening to the dialogue here, the weekly roundup special. And remember, we've got one more next week. Thank you very much, William, for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, Dewa.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.